Hello, do-it-yourselfer. Ever thought about gardening? If you can build that window box, you can build a raised bed in your backyard. Bonnie veggie and herb plants in raised beds make a fast weekend project with a big payback. Fresh, grow-em-yourself tomatoes and peppers, kale, basil and thyme, and so much more. Bonnie plants are healthy and strong and help jumpstart your garden. So get growing. Plans and how-tos at bonnieplants.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello and welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live from Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn, every Tuesday from roughly 12 to roughly 12:45, joined as usual by Nastasha the Hammer Lopez. How you doing, Stas?
Good.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Got Jack in the booth today.
Hey.
Good old-fashioned cooking issues.
Last week, my tires blew out in my car.
For real?
Yeah, that's actually why I wasn't here.
For real, your tires blew out?
For real.
Like, while you were driving?
Yeah, it was kind of flat, two of them, and I was like, let me drive to the gas station and fill them up, and then, you know. Yeah,
was it like, kaplow, or was it
kind of.
Like, yeah. Were you able to keep control of the car?
Yeah, I made it into a repair shop and got them replaced.
Yeah, I had a little bit of a car quarrel to you today. My old school, like, you don't think of this happening anymore with your car, but battery dead. Battery dead.
Is that why you're late?
Dead, yeah. I was going to work on the puffing gun, which we'll talk about in a minute, but the battery was completely muerto. Mm-hmm. And so I haven't had to have a jump since I was in, like, high school, you know? But, yeah, it works. Turns out I still know how to jumpstart a car. Also joined in the studio today, Emma Bost from the Museum of Food and Drink. Hey, what's your title there at the museum?
I am the program director, so I work with Peter, who's the executive director of MOFED, and a whole slew of amazing volunteers.
Yeah? Yeah? Nice. So, so Emma's here today. Actually, I forced her to come on because I'm a little bit late, because what we're doing this morning, as some of you might know, last summer we did a Kickstarter and we paid for this puffing gun. Now, puffing gun is an explosive puffing device that was used to make breakfast cereals. One of the big, I like to call it the big three of the initial breakfast cereals, right? So your initial big three were your flaking rollers, right? Three, right? No, two. Three.
Well, I guess you had your crumbled, your granula, kind of granola-esque cereals.
Right, that's the Oer. That's the Oer cereal, right? The Oer cereal. And by the way, remember, started by religious health zealots. Right, that's a fair term.
Zealots. Yeah.
So that meant to kind of taste bad and be dry and just kind of, you know, one of the original cereals' names was Pablum. Pablum.
I've got a caller.
Oh, caller. Well, we'll get back to the puffing gun in a minute. Caller, you're on the air.
Hey, Dave and crew. How y'all doing?
Doing all right.
Howdy.
Very well. Cool. I had two-part questions. One of them was, I had recently seen a video that Jose Andres had done, and he had made a mimosa with clementine air, he said. And he did it with soy lectin.
Yeah, he loves that stuff.
Yeah, and I tried to do it at home, and I just modified it by doing it with blood orange.
Right.
But since we didn't have any fresh blood oranges, I used just regular, it was already pasteurized. I got it from Whole Foods, but it was blood orange juice. And for some reason, I just couldn't make the air the same way that he does it. It ended up being real goopy.
Yeah. What was he using? Well, give me his whole technique, because I haven't seen the video.
Yeah. It was, he was making kava, and then he used fresh squeezed clementine juice, and I don't know if that's why, because one of the effects that mine didn't work at all.
Yeah, I mean, what was the procedure with the soy lecithin?
He was making mimosas.
No, what was the procedure with the soy lecithin?
So he used the immersion, not the immersion sort,
like a stick blender?
Yes, the stick blender.
Right.
And he just put like about a spoonful or so of soy lecithin inside of the clementine juice and just made like an air.
Right.
Like an air out of the clementine juice.
Okay, so
and put that on top.
And what did and he was using presumably the powdered stuff, right? Because there's also the granular stuff and there's the powdered stuff. Powdered stuff much better. Hopefully you had the powdered stuff. Okay, so you can add almost any kind of you know, he added no extra whipping agent, right? Just the he added just the soy lecithin to for the bubbling effect, right? No whipping agent. All right.
Yeah, just that.
And you've had luck using this the stick blender technique in the past, or do you need some pointers on the stick blender technique in general?
I mean, probably I need techniques altogether because I definitely just tried it bad. Like I just tried to attempt it on a brunch, and it was not a failure just off of looking. It didn't look as hard as it was, and clearly it was.
Right. Okay. So there's a trick.
I don't know if it was the type of soy lecithin that I got. Maybe it wasn't the same quality, or I don't know, but.
It's possible. I'm not a huge fan. I've never been like a soy lecithin guy. But what you should do is practice on something that foams naturally. Like, I was wondering if you've used this kind of technique in the past. Like, carrot juice is a natural foamer. You don't need to do anything to it at all. Just use carrot juice. You know, juice carrots and do it. But the trick with any of those kind of foam ups with a stick blender is you want to have not like a small quantity in the bottom of a container, stick the stick blender in it, and then you go on. And here's the key that I don't know whether they tell you about in the video or not, but you need to turn the entire thing at an angle such that a portion of the stick blender's blades come out of the liquid on every revolution. And then when you're holding it at that angle, you turn it on high, and as it flips up and out of the thing, it's going to be whipping air and creating a froth that will rise above the surface. So that's why when they're doing that technique, you'll see them all the time, and it's not just because they want to look jaunty. They need to have that container. I usually do it in quartz or whatever on an angle, usually pretty steep, like 45 or better, so that the blades can whip in and out. But you did that or no?
No, definitely didn't do that. I just held it directly in there, almost like a reverse blender, as it usually is, you know. So I definitely didn't get any air into it.
Right. So the trick with any of those foam things is he's adding a little bit of the soy lecithin to stabilize the bubbles a little bit. You're praying that there's a kind of enough solids in the juice to kind of hold those bubbles once they're formed with that, and then you just tilt it at an angle. You give it a try. Carrot juice is a good one to do it with. Tilt it at an angle and and you hold it, and it'll make like a froth on the top, and then you pull out the stick blender, and I'm sure you saw this part on the thing, is they take a spoon usually, and they harvest the stuff off the top of the liquid, and then you can do that a bunch because there's extra stuff in there before it's really depleted of the surface active stuff needed to make a foam. So they'll sit there, and they'll just re-hit it almost to order, and then harvest each time. It'll settle down after a while, and then you can just zit, 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 hit it again. But if you look at the video, I'm pretty sure you'll see him holding that thing at an angle.
Okay. Yeah, I'll definitely check that out.
I'm kind of surprised, though, that they didn't mention that, because it's kind of a key aspect of the technique. The, you know, other things you might want to try it depends. So those kinds of foams are usually extremely airy, like extremely airy, right? If you want something a little bit denser, Methocel F50 is really cool. That makes more of like a shaving cream or a Guinness-y kind of head. And you're going to want to use like 0.8%, so like 8 grams per liter. And then you blend that in a blender to hydrate. Let it hydrate for a long time. Sometimes it takes a while to hydrate. And then you can whip that thing in a KitchenAid, and it foams up. Now, you need to have enough solids to get it to work right. So if you don't, you can add some maltodextrin, you know, not like a crazy one like Enzorbit, just something like a bulking agent or a whipping agent like that. You can get an orange juice to come up into like almost like a shaving cream, but it'll be a little bit denser but much more persistent than the one that you were dealing with there. You know, like a good one for that would be actually, do they make purees of that? They do make purees of that, but I don't know how dense they are. You need a little bit of pectin, a little bit of structure with the methocel to get it to work.
Excellent, yeah. And then, I mean, that's great. I'll definitely try that for next time. And the other one that I had, the other question was, I'm trying to make a healthier, I guess, ice cream for my parents. Everyone has a sweet tooth, obviously. And the one that I was trying to make was out of a coconut milk
instead.
And the issue that I have is everything flavor-wise comes out good, but when I put it inside the fridge, it gets really hard. And I'm trying to see whatever commercial techniques, because any regular ice cream you put inside there will stay still airy and fluffy, and I don't know if it's a combination of gums that I should put in there, or what. I mean, it's just coconut water substituting, I'm sorry, coconut milk substituting traditional milk or whipping milk.
Right, but it's substituting for both the cream and the milk, right?
Yeah.
Right. So a couple of things. Probably your fat concentration is probably a little low. But you know, you can, obviously sorbets work, right? So the other thing is probably your sugar level might be a little bit low. Is it a lot less sweet than typical ice cream?
I would say per quart, I put about a cup typically of a sweetener of sugar.
Now I have to do some math here. So like I can't think of it in terms of quart to cup. A cup, well, that weighs roughly 8 ounces, and so a quart is four. So four. Sorry, I'm doing some stuff in my head, right? So you're saying you're putting in 8 ounces of sugar into 32 ounces of product. That gives you a total weight of 40 and 8. Yeah, so that's like 16. So that should be sweet enough, right? Right. It tastes sweet enough, then, right?
Yeah.
Huh. Because usually, like, overly solid things are due, and, like, textural problems like that are due to lack of sugar or, you know, especially if it's good when it's soft, it means it's free. It's, you know, you say it's good when it's soft, right?
Yeah. Definitely taste-wise, before I make it hard, it tastes great.
Yeah, but in other words, when you initially churn it, before it turns hard, that it tastes fine when it's before it's been aged, right?
Exactly, yes.
Yeah. Okay, so typically, overly hard on storage is going to be it's getting too solid, and you control the solids by controlling the meltdown rate, and you control the meltdown rate by how much sugar is in it. So, I mean, I guess it's hard for me to do the numbers on the fly. I have to go back and remember exactly what my target bricks for is for a sorbet. You want to treat it like a sorbet, basically, even though it has the addition of the – because it's easier to calculate. That's how I calculate. I do all my sorbets with coconut milk. They're fairly sweet, right? So I tend to use coconut cream because it's got sugar in it, and it's so easy for me. Like, I can just buy, like, a package of puree and then, like, a package of coconut a can of coconut cream. I know this sounds like real, like I'm not working, but but it's easy for me because I do it at home for the kids and mix them together, and it works fantastically well. I just have to recalculate. Do the recalculation on the sugar and go look up, because I don't have it off the top of my head, like the target bricks for like a sorbet. Ignore the fat content of the coconut milk to start with, because it's not going to hurt you in terms of your calculations, and figure out a target bricks for it, and then see whether or not you're going a little bit too low on the sugar. Because did it taste kind of less sweet than normal? Good, but less sweet than normal?
No, I mean, taste-wise, everything was good. It's usually more so, like you said, just in the aging, it gets too hard inside the fridge. And I can put a commercial ice cream in there, and it will still... It's soft, but
I mean, you could add some whipping agents to it to try and increase the air. Commercial coconut milk already has some usually has some product in it to stop it from breaking, because regular coconut milk will break when you heat it, and canned stuff usually typically doesn't. I don't know if you're making it yourself or not. But if you're using canned, that typically will have some stuff in it. But you could add some sort of a thickener, like a locust bean or a flavor-free guar to it, and see whether that helps you out a little bit. But if this sucker tastes good when it's soft, it's probably not an overrun problem. So, like, if it's overly dense when it gets hard, but it doesn't temper out nicely either. Like, it doesn't, when you pull it out of the freezer for a little while, does it scoop nicely eventually and get back to good texture, or does it just turn like a rock and stays a rock until it's melted?
No, I mean, it eventually goes back to a nice texture. You can definitely scoop it again.
Right, so it could be density. It could be density, in which case you might want to up the solid. So it's coconut milk and what?
Coconut milk. I definitely put the coconut cream in too, like you're saying, and I do use the can.
Right.
And then... every once in a while I'll throw some liqueur in there as well, depending on what flavor I'm doing.
Right. That'll make it softer. Yeah. But I wonder whether you need a higher solids content, whether it's not, it's just not churning enough. You know what I'm saying? Like you might want to.
Yeah, sometimes I'll put in like I'll put in coconut nectar to hopefully make like a so it's definitely nectar, like a syrup instead of actual sugar. I don't know if that could be a problem, perhaps.
No, I mean, like, if you added too much sugar, it would get too soft, right? And it wouldn't freeze properly. It wouldn't get too hard. So if this stuff does come back to being kind of in good temper again and it's sweet enough, then it could be that you're just not getting enough overrun. And so you need to add some something that's going to increase the actual overrun, the whipping ability of it, in which case that would be more solids probably. And then maybe something that aerates it more. You know what? Like, if anyone's listening that has a good kind of a breakdown on this, because usually when I'm doing coconut milk, it's not straight coconut milk. It's coconut milk and a fruit puree. And the pectins that are in the fruit purees are helping me with solids, with body. And I think maybe that's what, you know, what's going on. If you see whether or not you have the same problem when you do a flavor that has more solids. Like I've done a really good coconut milk sorbet style stuff is with chocolate. Like chocolate coconut milk sorbet is fantastic. So you take like coconut milk and or cream and melt chocolate into it, and I usually also add cocoa powder because I want really dense kind of chocolate flavor, and that texture comes out pretty nicely. So you might want to see whether or not it's just a solids issue, whether you just don't have enough actual solids in it.
For sure. Excellent. I'll definitely try that out.
But again, this is off the top of my head, so hopefully I'm not off base and be like, that guy does not know what the hell he's talking about.
No, not at all. I mean, you, as a matter of fact, I was just going to say that I've listened to as many of your previous podcasts that you've done. I've become enthralled and your biggest fan by far. I've watched your Harvard talk. And I can't wait for your cocktail book to come out, and then your Sears all.
Wow.
I've donated a few times over, waiting for the new one to come out.
Cool. Well, appreciate it. Well, it's we're actually talking to our suppliers right now, Styles. Right, we're looking. We're hopefully going to be on time. We might be a couple weeks late. Right.
Right.
A couple. I hope not. We're gonna update more as we go. But I'll tell you something. I won't be talking out of my behind in the cocktail book. That thing has been thoroughly vetted. In fact, like, you know what, one of the weird things that we had recipe change on was with the Campari and soda. Like, so we have on the bar now, we have a recipe that's the Booker and Dax take on Campari and soda. And, you know, the benefit is you can carbonate the whole thing. So although, you know, Nastasha here likes any Campari and soda variant, right? No matter, regardless of like how well or poorly it is carbonated. You know, at Booker and Dax, we like to carbonate everything, right? And we're also kind of, people rib us because our drinks tend to be, like, everyone claims that our drinks are high in alcohol, even though they're the same amount of alcohol that you'd have in any beverage. So we do the Campari and soda, and we use champagne acid. So champagne acid is a mixture of lactic acid and tartaric. And the reason is because although the grapes have a balance of tartaric and malic acid, most champagnes, one of the notable exceptions is Krug. Are you like Krug? Yeah, so you notice how Krug, Staza, is shaking her head. She's so happy thinking about champagne that she can't, like, the words can't even come to her mouth. But she, Krug has a kind of an apple-y note on it, a green, fresh apple-y note on it. And that's because of the malic acid, because Krug does not go through malolactic fermentation, whereas most champagnes do. And when they go through malolactic fermentation, the acids turn from malic to lactic. And so the champagne acid we use is a blend of lactic and tartaric. But the weird, here's where it gets weird. So we add that instead of a squeeze of lime, we add that to, and we did this, by the way, before the lime craziness, where the lime prices are so high now. we do it so that the Campari and soda alike drinks more like a wine and less like a cocktail. Crazy thing is, turns out that if you bottle the stuff, add the acid, carbonate it, and let it sit overnight, that the bitterness, the inherent bitterness of the Campari is amplified, like, greatly. So it tastes delicious when you make it, and then the next day it's kind of unpalatably bitter. And it's not unpalatably bitter in that it's like so bitter. It's like the bitterness lingers. It just lingers. And we did a test. We did a test with adding it before. You know, we ran a test in putting Aperol in because Aperol is, you know, less bitter. And Aperol also gets, you know, Aperol, for those of you that don't drink Aperol, Aperol is like Campari's slightly sweeter, slightly less alcoholic cousin. And we did it with Aperol. Aperol also got bitter. So it now, and we don't know why. I have no idea why, but we tested it without the acid in it, and it was fine. It was stable. So something about storing diluted Campari or Aperol in the presence, and I don't know whether it's any acid because we didn't test it with you know, malic or like a lime acid blend. We tested it just with lactic and tartaric, the champagne acid. But something about it causes the liquor to change overnight. It's very odd. I have no idea why. I just know it empirically to be the case. So that's a recipe that was in the book that now I'm going to have to add a little footnote, because once we had tested it for stability in the bar, we noticed this phenomena that we completely didn't anticipate, because the acid itself, unlike lime juice or lemon juice, which is known to go bad over time, you know, it's not the acids that go bad, and it's not the product, it's the actual juice that goes bad. So I had not expected that in a Campari situation. So should we take our first commercial break? Come back with some cooking issues?
Yes.
Let's do it.
Hello, do-it-yourselfer. Ever thought about gardening? If you can build that window box, you can build a raised bed in your backyard. Bonnie veggie and herb plants in raised beds make a fast weekend project with a big payback. Fresh, grow-em-yourself tomatoes and peppers, kale, basil and thyme, and so much more. Bonnie plants are healthy and strong and help jumpstart your garden. So get growing. Plans and how-tos at bonnieplants.com.
Are we back?
And we're back.
And we're back with cooking issues. I never can tell. Like sometimes, like it ends abruptly. Sometimes we you know,
kind of keep you on your toes.
I know it. Even though we're sitting on our duffs here.
You mentioned the lime shortage thing before. It's crazy. I was reading all these articles. People were like, yeah, I'm just going to sub lemons. I mean, that's crazy, you know?
Yeah, that won't work.
That won't work.
So, you know, just, you know, well, I mean, if you don't care, if you're an enemy of quality, you know, then it won't matter. Then, you know, it's fine. You can do whatever you want. You can substitute, you know, I don't know, swill. It doesn't matter. But if you want it, the stuff that, like lemons and limes don't taste the same. They don't function the same way. And strangely, you can tell more once a drink is made that you, like, so some people make the mistake of tasting just lime juice and just lemon juice and thinking, like, well, it's, you know, it's like, because it's something that's that acidic, like those, the differences between the two are only going to come out more as when they're used in a drink. We ran a test. So both lime juice and so much more than Jack was hoping for. We ran a test with lemon juice and lemon juice and lime juice are roughly 6% acidity. Lemon juice, the acid predominantly, just forget the vitamin C because ascorbic acid doesn't really affect the flavor of it that much, is citric. That's the bulk of the acid in a lemon. And in a lime, it's instead of 6% citric, it's more like, and it's give or take, right? It's like 4% citric and 2% malic. And it's that citric-malic blend that creates the natural acidity of lime. Now, the trick is, you know, we tried to do a fake thing where we took lemon and then doped it with malic acid and water so that it was still 6%, but it had the correct blend, and it wasn't quite right. Part of the thing when you're most of the time when you're using a citrus like a lemon or a lime, you're shaking a cocktail. When you're shaking a cocktail, it's not just the acidity you need. You actually need the surface active properties of the juice itself, the pectins, whatever else is in it, that cause shaking cocktails to hold air better, right, and become, you know, kind of better shaking cocktails. So I don't know whether it just tasted not as good or whether or not, you know, we could just tell because it didn't have that kind of peel note that's in lime juice. Of course, that I could have faked it by adding a little bit of succinic acid, which is the secret ingredient in lime acid, and also hard to source. But we weren't able to get a good thing even when we were specifically trying to do a sub out. So during the shortage, we have less lime juice shaking cocktails and more of our lemon juice shaking cocktails on the menu. Luckily, we are not forced to use one or the other. But you know, the thing about it is, Jack, is that even though limes are ridiculously expensive now, like a factor of four, I think, I forget what the recent numbers are.
Yeah, it's crazy like that.
Yeah, it's. Well, and you pay by the case, which is a certain case count, but the amount of juice that's in the ones we're getting now is nothing. So it's like, you know, we're in that time of year anyway where when you juice the lime, like two drops of juice come out of the lime. And so they're expensive and useless. So the actual price difference isn't even enough of a factor to factor in how bad they are. But still, relative to expensive liquor, it's still – you know, and relative to the use rate, you know, you can kind of afford it. Although the issue is just, you know, we don't want to order too much because we throw it away at the end of the night. So it gets expensive if you make a lot extra and then you have to throw it away at the end of the night. Or we don't actually throw it away. We give it to the kitchen because the kitchen can use it in cooking applications that, you know, we can't use it for in drinks anymore. But yeah, it's a pain in the butt. Hopefully I'm told that all of that nonsense will be over in May. At the end of May.
What's the definite time?
There'll be another crop coming in. This one is shafted by a number of things. So everyone says it's the cartels. I like to say it's the cartels. But, you know, they had a spot of weather, as we say.
It's the cartels. Come on.
Okay, all right. Well, I mean, like, I want it to be the cartels, right? That's what we all want.
It's a better story.
Yeah, you know. It's like, but if it was the cartels, right, avocados come from a similar area, don't they? Like, sure. Avocado prices haven't spiked as much as limes. Of course, you don't need armed guards lime trucks now require armed guards. I think the last time I read an article, and it's good, I'm talking out of my behind, so I could be wrong, but what the article I read was that a tractor trailer of limes had, like, you know, a street value of over $100,000 now.
Oh,
so it's
God.
Like, you know, I mean, not, it's a lot of freaking limes, but you got to remember, like, you know, I'm used to limes being like, you know, $7-$8 for a dollar, you know, at the Essex Street Market where I buy limes and cheap avocados and Anne's delicious but not inexpensive cheese. That would be Anne's Saxby. But isn't that weird, that market? They have like people who are selling the cheapest possible avocados in bulk and then like Anne's Saxby. It's a strange market setup, right?
It's a cool market.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Unfortunately, it's only going to be more of the latter going forward, I think.
More of
yeah.
Which one? Which one's the latter?
Of the delicious but not inexpensive items.
I don't know. I think that they're obliged to keep the avocado vendors there. I mean, there's like five or six. I mean, the reason is there's five or six people that sell very similar styles of produce there. And so they're beaten. Their prices get beaten down pretty hardcore. Anytime someone who's there who has something that isn't duplicated three and four times, the price tends to rise a little bit. But I don't know. Jack, you used to work there every once in a while, right?
At the market? No, but I mean, the Heritage Meat Shop's there, so I've spent some time there.
I just saw you when you hung out at the – because you used to hang out occasionally at the Heritage Meat Shop in the market.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
It's a great spot.
Yeah, someday someone will tell – so Heritage Meat, we won't talk.
If you're in New York, go to the Essex Street Market and get a Heritage pork chop and some Saxelby cheese. How about that?
There you go. And you can eat – I've never eaten at Shop since. You eaten there?
Oh, I haven't, but he's apparently a crazy guy.
Yeah, again, we're just a little like inside ball for New Yorkers, but there's a lunatic there at Shops. That's his second location, right? You ever eaten there, Emma?
No, I haven't.
He's like an old school lunatic. He's like the soup Nazi for breakfast. Is that accurate?
Yeah,
I mean, we had the menu in our office for a while, just as a kind of piece on its own on the wall to look at occasionally.
He has a book, right? He won't serve you if he doesn't like you, right?
So I've heard.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't want to have to be judged. I just want to eat breakfast. And then go in peace. What about you, Stas? What do you think? Do you like being judged when you're having breakfast?
No.
You just want to eat?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Do you like judging while you eat breakfast?
Stas, do you like judging while you eat breakfast?
I don't usually eat breakfast out. I don't eat breakfast, actually.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
most important meal of the day. Yeah.
Which brings us back to cereal.
Yes, which brings us back to cereal. But she does judge when we both judge when we eat. Like, we're both pretty rough. Like, we're
Dave's
both pretty
really
mean.
Rough.
What? Whoa,
you're
whoa.
Really, really rough.
What?
Especially to women, you're really rough.
How am I rough to women?
So
that's a lie.
Rough.
I'm first of all, I'm way rougher on men than on
way.
Women. Emma, back me up on this. You hung out with me
she's
before.
Hung out as much.
I'm not
yeah.
sure I've had enough meals with you. Certainly I've eaten here.
What women am I rough on?
Oh my
besides
God.
You.
Like any woman that he sees online, like instant.
It,
like anything, like a Twitter follower or like anything
what?
That you see on your computer that's a woman, you're like, look at her. She's busted.
What?
Are you kidding me?
That is not true at all. That is a straight... First of all, not only is that, like, I am actually offended. That is a freaking lie. That's a freaking lie. What I show you is when people on Twitter follow me who aren't real, who clearly are not real people, who are out there trolling to get men to look at them to, like, trade some sort of pictures. It's the fake people that I point out. I don't point out
okay.
any real people.
Okay.
It's people that I think are fake people.
Okay.
You know what I'm talking about. Jack, you know what I'm talking about on the Twitter,
I
right?
I do, unfortunately.
Yeah, I look at it, I'm like, that's not real. You know what I mean? Like, they, you know, and then they're like, you know, email me for the picture. I'm not going to email you for pictures. What do I need with your picture for? I don't need a picture.
Well, we've got a call.
Caller, you're on the air.
Hey. So since your MOFAD person is here, I was going to ask you, is there any update on the Boom cereal? Are you guys going to be able to make that?
Oh, on the actual cereal? All right, Emma, why don't you say what we're up to?
What a segue.
Yeah, so indeed, yeah, we were actually just at the machine today, and it was kind of in hibernation over the winter, and needed a little bit of care after the long, rough winter that we had in New York. But the gun is in beautiful working order, and we've been puffing a lot of rice and kind of trying to perfect the recipe on that front. I think we may also be testing out some various wheat varieties. We had stayed away from wheat and gluten-containing grains initially, but I think there might be a possibility to try those out, actually, after all. Sorry to everyone who is celiac, but there's just too many possibilities out there. So I think we should be able to get those bags of puffs to everyone probably by the end of the summer. I know it's a year later, but there was just a lot of downtime when we couldn't use the gun over the winter, so...
Oh, that's fine. That's going to be very exciting.
Yeah,
all right,
and we're going to fire the gun at our
Dave.
What do you say?
I got a question for you. A few weeks back, you were talking about the merits of Vitamixes, and you mentioned something about blending a pound of bacon into pasta sauce or tomato sauce or something.
Oh, yeah.
Is there a recipe behind that?
No, it's just what happened. And luckily, my wife does not listen to this show because she hates when I tell this story. But the I hate it when people pick things out of food. I hate it. You know what I mean? Like, unless you're actually allergic to it, like, I detest when things get picked out of things. I don't like when sandwiches get picked apart. Like, when someone gets a sandwich and they rip it open and they take all the guts out. And my kids do it all the time. It's, like, a constant source of irritation to me. But it just gets to me. So I used to make sauces, right? And then with bacon, right? And then at the end of the night, there'd be a little pile of bacon in the bottom of the bowl because the bacon had been, you know, picked around or whatever. And it's not because my wife is not one of these people, by the way, who is, you know, afraid of eating fat. You know, in fact, one of the reasons I knew that she was the woman for me was because we once went to a Popeye's fried chicken and she wasn't paying attention to what was going on. She took a whole bucket down by herself. I mean, this lady knows how to eat. So it's not that, but it was just something about it. And I was just, And so then I got the VitaPrep, and instead of having the bacon maintained in the so it was a visible thing, I was like, to hell with it. After, you know, normally I would cook out the bacon, remove the bacon, sweat out the whatever alliums I'm using in the bacon fat, add the tomato, whatever else, cook down, blend, add bacon back at the end for crunch and texture. And then, you know, one day I was like, to hell with it. And I just blended it into the sauce, and it was so smooth, so smooth. And so there was no way possibly to pull the bacon out anymore. I was like, when?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I've noticed that I have that problem when I'm making like pots and sauces with bacon that I can't incorporate the bacon. It tends to stir out. You know
yeah.
what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And
it like ends up at the bottom of the bowl when you're tossing. Solution. It ends up at the bottom of the bowl when you're tossing, is what you're saying, with separating out?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And, you know, the bacon is a fun part. I don't know how much we would lose in texture by doing it that way, but I'm going to give it a try anyway.
Yeah, here's what you should do. Blend it in for flavor, and then maybe save some, and then sprinkle over top like at service.
Yeah, like garnish bacon, but then most of the bacon will be emulsified bacon.
Yeah, that's the way to go.
Oh, this would be awesome.
Yeah.
That's all right, thank you very much.
All right, tweet on in. Tell me how it tastes.
Cool,
thanks a lot. All right, so going back to the gun for a minute, and then I got a question on the thing I have to hit before we go. But, okay, so we're at the gun today, and it's actually going to be at our benefit, right?
Yes.
So you want to talk about the benefit for a second?
May 7th.
Right.
It's going to be here in New York at an awesome place called The Foundry, which is in Long Island City. And one great perk of this venue that we found, it's in an industrial area, so we can drive up the Puffing Gun, unlike, you know, some sort of gala hall in Manhattan where, you know, space is limited. So we're going to pull up the Puffing Gun and hopefully do a couple of preview shots for people. So that's why we were there today. The benefit is going to be a huge, huge affair. I mean, we've got 8 of these amazing chefs lined up, each of whom is tackling a different museum-themed course. So, for example, I was recently emailing back and forth a little bit with Amanda Cohen of Dirt Candy, a vegetable-centric restaurant in the East Village, and her theme is Korea before the chili, i.e. pre-Columbian Korean right. cuisine. And for that matter, you could do that with a number of South Asian or Southeast Asian cuisines that rely heavily on chilies. So I think she said she's making a few different kinds of kimchi that are chili-free kimchi.
The old white ones?
Yes, yeah. I think so.
Nice.
Yeah.
Sounds good. What else we got? Why don't you tell them who's... And you can still buy tickets if you've got the cash. Just go to mofad.com or .org, right?
Yeah, benefit.mofad.org is the place for tickets. So we've got individual tickets, and then also if you got a group of buddies or colleagues, you can buy a table. So
right. Why don't you run through the chefs and what they're doing?
So we've also got Franklin Becker of The Little Beat, who has What Massasoit Brought to Thanksgiving. Now, this is a bit controversial because the idea of a first Thanksgiving is pretty contentious historically. I think most food historians would say there probably was no first Thanksgiving in the way that we have idealized it here in the U.S. That being said, there is a primary source, one or two letters that mention that this Wampanoag chief Massasoit brought 5 deer to a gathering with colonists in Plymouth. So
deer tastes good.
Venison in May maybe is a little dicey. I think the approach with this course is probably going to be something more along lines of foraged food, since it's spring and would be in keeping with the Native American cuisine theme.
All right, what else we got?
Let's see. Wiley Dufresne, WD-50, longtime supporter of MOFAD, is tackling the 4 humors. So the sort of extremely outdated notion that human physiology is based on these 4 substances, with black bile, yellow bile, phlegm, and blood, I believe,
That's not true?
Not sure when it was debunked, but it was quite a while ago. So he's going to be kind of exploring this theme of food as medicine, the intersection between food and health, through this theme.
Right.
I'm not exactly sure
what he's going to do. It was an incredibly influential view in medieval cookery. And so, a lot of medieval cookery was based around, the idea was is you wanted to center yourself, not too phlegmatic or moist and, cold, not too hot, not too dry. So you had your phlegmatic and your cold, your hot and your dry, and you got to get and as represented by the different actual bodily humors, the biles and whatnot. But it's a very interesting and demented. Every food had its own sort of rating, and every cooking method had its own sort of rating. So roasting would be hot and dry, and there's all different. And so like kind of balancing all that. Interesting idea. Who else we got?
Let's see. Also, I'm really excited about this one personally. Dominique Anzel of Cronut fame, although I'm sure he hates to be cast in that light, is taking on food on the battlefield. And apparently he used to actually for a short time, was a cook for the French military. And so he's got some actual hands-on experience doing this kind of food. And I think he's going to be doing a pastry course, as far as I know. And I think the presentation will be very interesting there. I don't want to give away the secret entirely, but
right. We got Brooks Headley's doing Food of Future Past, right?
Yes, so a more conceptual theme. I haven't checked in with him, so again, not sure what that course is like in terms of its development.
Michael Anthony got TV Dinners.
Yes, another one where the presentation is going to be critical. And the idea there is we'll do a short video pitch on MOFAD, since we're going to be announcing some big plans for the coming years, along with Michael Anthony's TV Dinner.
Nice, which is hilarious. And that's everyone, right?
No, we've also got Nils Noren.
Oh, Nils. Yeah, what's Nils? Nils, oh my God, the best. He's doing Italian cuisine.
Rastafarian Italian cuisine.
Oh, exactly. I love Nils. Nils is a huge reggae fan. What else we got? Who else we got?
Let's see. And yeah.
That's it? That's it. Sweet. Oh, and then I'm going to hit this question real quick.
We've got Sean Gray of Momofuku Co.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah. See, the thing is, whenever you're listing things out of order, it's better to list things in order. What's his topic?
He's got Pennsylvania Dutch food. He actually hails from Pennsylvania, as I understand.
Yeah, he's from, like, Lancaster County, right?
Right. So this will be hitting close to home for him in some way.
Sweet. All right. And that's everyone, right?
Yes.
You got everyone now? All right, nice. All right. If we have a second on the way out, we're going to do a pitch for the roundtable, too, MOFAD roundtable. But we got a question in from Alex in Santa Barbara. Hello, Dave, Natasha, Jack, and maybe. He gave you a maybe, Jack. Rough.
Maybe, wow.
Wow. And everyone else that's there today, once again, thanks for the program. It's greatly appreciated. The question is a bit long, so please feel free to edit for your show. I believe we all do uneconomical things in or for the kitchen. For example, last summer, I grew $25 tomatoes because I only managed to grow four of them. So I spent $100 total, got four tomatoes, $25. The year before, I was giving them away and figured I could repeat my success, but it didn't work out. I would have been much better off buying farmers market tomatoes for $10 and saving $90. The only reason I tried to grow them was because the tomatoes the year before were very good and very plentiful. This came up because my friend was just getting into home brewing. I immediately thought back to my tomatoes and figured he was about to spend a lot of money, time, and effort to produce a product far inferior to what he could purchase easily. I understand the journey is part of the fun, but sometimes the cost isn't worth it. I do not brew my own soy sauce, roast my own coffee beans, smoke my own bacon, or keep a sourdough starter. The time, energy, and cost are not worth it compared to what is readily available. On the other hand, I never order something at a restaurant that I can pull off almost as well, if not far better, at home. A New York strip steak is a great example. Instead, I try to order something which takes much more time and energy at home. Additionally, I never purchased a half-quart container of diced onions or jar of crushed garlic. That crushed garlic is gross. No offense. People who make it. I cannot believe those products sell well enough for the stores to stock them. I refuse to believe I'm alone in thinking this way. Like I said above, I can understand the journey and the experience is part of the fun. That said, what do you think are the uneconomical efforts put forth at home? More importantly, what are the products that should never be purchased because the cost, quality, effort are such that making them at home because the cost, quality, effort are such that making them at home is a bad idea, I think. I went ahead of my brain. Hopefully the spirit of the question came through this email. Some of the things off the top of my head, peanut butter, right? He only buys it, and he has friends that object. I buy peanut butter because commercial peanut butter is delicious, and you don't have a mill. I guarantee you don't have a mill that can produce peanut butter with the same texture as the stuff that you ever had any natural, like, home-ground peanut butter you thought was really good?
No.
I know people who like that kind of texture. I'm not one of them. I like good old-fashioned
emulsified.
Sweetened U.S. peanut butter. Hell yeah. Hell yeah. That stuff's good. Hot sauce. I always buy it. I think here's the thing. I'm going to answer in general, and then I'm going to go over some of these things. So, for instance, learning how to do everything, like – being a brewer for a while, if not for your whole life. If you like brewing, you should keep doing it because it's rewarding if you do it right. It is a pain in the butt to do all grain brewing. But I think doing anything once or twice is worthwhile if you want to know how things work, even if you're not going to make the kind of best product. The only thing that I haven't done really in this list – I mean, I haven't done soy sauce, but wines, because I like, you don't have really control over the raw ingredients to even get kind of usually a reasonable expectation of the highest quality on wine. So one reason I haven't hit it yet, because I don't have a lock on the really high quality inputs. But like beer, you can get extremely high quality inputs and you can make good beer. So do I brew beer anymore? No. After my second son was born, I don't do it anymore because it was a huge mess. But I did it for a while. Same with roasting coffee. I used to roast all my own coffee beans, and I think it's really good. Other people can do as good a job or better job than I can do, but I enjoyed learning about it, and I feel like I know much more about coffee for having done it. Ditto sourdough starters. I no longer maintain one, but I maintained one for a long time, and I think it was worthwhile to kind of feel what it's like to have something on a continuous basis that you have to take care of in your kitchen that made delicious bread. So I think that it's often worthwhile to go through the effort to do it, but not necessarily worth the effort to maintain it for your whole life. Does that make sense? Make sense? All right, let's go over these one by one. Style's like, I don't care. Tofu, you said you liked yours homemade, but I read up on the process and now testing out everything the local Japanese market has to offer because I can't see myself going through all that effort. Here's another thing. Tofu is only hard the first four times you make it. As soon as your kitchen is streamlined and you have all the stuff ready and you've gone through the procedure so you're not wondering what's going on, it's actually not that difficult to make tofu. You just have to remember to soak the stuff beforehand is the only big whoopty crap. So a lot of these things that are difficult are only difficult because we don't do them often. Cheese. I always buy, but I'm starting to think I should try my hand at my own ricotta at the very least with McGee's book in hand. What about you, Emma? You make your own cheese?
No, actually. I think I've only done simple kind of fresh cheeses, paneer, things of that sort.
So. Yeah, and I'm not very good at it. What about you, Stas? You ever make your own mozzarella or anything?
No.
See, I think there's a huge art to making something like a mozzarella. Ricotta I could try. But like real whey ricotta or like the whole milk ricotta that one makes? I don't know about that. Puff pastry dough. I buy the frozen sheets. I've made it in the past and cannot tell the difference, which might say more about my pastry skills than it does about the quality of the frozen sheets. I make my own puff paste, but I like making it. I enjoy the process of making it.
Yeah, I like laminated doughs. They're time-consuming, but they don't actually take a lot of effort. You just need to be able to take it out of the freezer, over the course of a day, 10
yeah.
times.
So. I would say mine's probably worse than the stuff you can buy, but I enjoy making it. What about you, Stu? You ever do laminated doughs like that?
No.
No? Not your jammy? Are you much of a baker or more of a cook?
Cook.
You don't like to bake much, right?
No.
Even cookies?
No.
No? Especially cookies. Cake mix. This one's a tough call because the box is so very easy, but I like to think from scratch cakes are better. I don't like cake mixes. I never use cake mixes. I think it's an insult because it's literally like the stuff that they put in that box you can just buy and measure out. Same with pancake mix. I don't get it. I don't like that hyper-uniform texture that they provide. I never use them, ever.
Yeah, well, and particularly when you read about the history of the development of cake mixes and how they initially had made them so it was really almost just add water and then found that through kind of consumer research, housewives were didn't really enjoy the process of making these cakes. There was too little to do, so they reformulated them. So you had to add egg and add a little bit of, put in a tiny bit of effort.
So, yeah, so what the hell? It's like I don't use Bisquick. No offense to Bisquick. I don't use self-rising flour because I know how baking powder works, Tortillas. I buy them, have made them, both corn and flour, but the local shop makes a fine product. I think it's it's a huge pain in the ass to make tortillas, but I still think I'd rather have – I use the store-bought ones like in a pinch like for a normal weekday meal and heat them up. If I don't have time, it's been a while since I've done the full nixtamalization. I think it's definitely a worthwhile road to go down, but it's a pain. But like if I'm really in a hurry, Maseca is not that much slower. So you just buy Maseca to do the tortillas. Dried pasta. I've made my own pasta, but fresh is definitely different than dried. Not necessarily better, depending on the shape. For things like spaghetti, the dried is preferred. Yeah, dried pasta is delicious. I like dried pasta. I like making fresh pasta, but to make fresh pasta well, you need to, efficiently, to have it not be a pain in the butt, you need to have your kitchen set up to do it. So I used to always have my pasta, my rollers clamped onto my work surface, and everything was there. And by the time water was boiling, I could almost have fresh pasta done because I didn't do what you're supposed to do. I didn't give it the rest periods you're supposed to give it and all this, and it still tasted good, and so I used to make fresh pasta 2-3 times a week. My kitchen's not really set up for it right now. And then finally, mayonnaise. This one's a tough call. If I'm going to make a dressing such as ranch or blue cheese, oh my God, Dax loves ranch dressing. Then I will put forth the effort, but for sandwiches and the like, I go with the jar, though lately I've been enjoying the Hampton's Food Alternative. I think you get the idea. I'm looking forward to your information on the things I could buy but shouldn't. I'll have to come back next week with other ideas, and I'll think about this. But I'll tell you this. I I like mayonnaise in a jar. I like jarred mayonnaise. I enjoy commercial mayonnaise. I think that stuff is delicious. Now, I still know how to make mayonnaise, and I make mayonnaise from time to time. But I like mayonnaise in a jar. Jack, you?
Mayonnaise is one of the few things I don't like, so.
At all?
Yeah. Weird, right?
It is weird.
Yeah. I mean, if it's on something, I'll take it, but I'm never like, I don't know, never reaching for the mayo.
Stas, what's your mayo thoughts?
I like it.
But do you like it from a jar or do you like fresh?
Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, they're pretty different things, I think. But I mean, I'm pretty partial to QP myself. But
oh, QP is delicious. You get that in the Asian markets. QP in the little thing. Well, I wish Stas ended on such a high note with the Anyway. I wish we were still allowed to use commercial music. Then we could leave on Any Way You Want It. That's the way, you know, the Journey song. You like that one? Or is that one of the ones you don't like? Yeah. All right. So anyway, we'll come back with more things that you should or should not make at home next week on Cooking Issues.
This is Chris.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.